Today, regular haircuts and medical breakthroughs. What the next few months of living with coronavirus could look like. So you've been covering the coronavirus story since January. I remember interviewing you for a Today in Focus episode, actually, about the lockdown in Wuhan. How has it felt covering this story for so long and so intensely? And do you feel like you're almost coming out of the other side now?
It feels a bit like being a war correspondent, where there is nothing in your life except for this one story. I've reported on global pandemics before, for sure. I went out to Sierra Leone to cover Ebola. I went to Brazil to cover Zika. But that's always a pandemic on somebody else's turf. And it's very different when you're right in the middle of it. There's really nothing else that's in my life apart from this, if I'm not careful. Work-life balance has disappeared, shall we say, totally.
This Saturday marks a key moment in England's journey out of lockdown. We'll all be able to do things we've wanted to for months, like drink a pint at a pub or have a haircut. But the relaxation of the rules probably isn't going to guarantee an improvement to the workload of The Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley, as some scientists worry the loosening of restrictions could lead to a spike in cases.
We're on a knife edge. It's very precarious, the situation in particularly England at the moment. And I would anticipate we would see an increase in new cases over the coming weeks.
In Leicester, a coronavirus outbreak in early June could mean that the area is closed for two more weeks, with the Prime Minister warning that as a country, we have to remain vigilant.
We are concerned about Leicester. We're concerned about any local outbreak. And I want to stress to people that, you know, we are not out of the woods yet.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, does another lifting of lockdown restrictions guarantee a second wave? And are we better prepared this time around?
Mr. Speaker, given the significant fall in the prevalence of the virus, we can change the 2 metre social distancing rule from the 4th of July.
Sarah, a lot of things are changing this Saturday. With businesses following strict hygiene rules, we'll be able to go to the pub for a pint, eat out at a restaurant, go on holiday in the UK, and perhaps most importantly, have a haircut. And social distancing measures are going to change as well, with the Prime Minister now saying that people should try to keep 2 metres apart, but where they can't, 1 metre will do. What is the science behind this?
Well, we've always known that the distance we should stay apart is slightly arbitrary. It doesn't mean that you're safe at 2 metres. It means that you are safer than you would be if you were much closer to people. It's not the only factor. So it's a time as well as a distance thing. What they're saying now is that if we reduce that to 1 metre, but we don't spend very long with each other, and we also take certain other precautions, such as wearing face masks or washing hands all the time, then we will be safe. In fact, the World Health Organization has always talked about 1 metre separation. There are risks and balances in this, and it's really been deemed that we want to carry on a proper life, you know, functioning normal life as insofar as we can. So 1 metre distance is a far more useful thing in that regard. It's to do with the economy as well as our health, shall we put it like that?
How close or how far we can be from people does seem to depend then on whether we are indoors or outdoors. And as you've mentioned, the rules on this are changing too. We can now spend time indoors with another household and can watch a film in the cinema. Is this much riskier than being outside?
Yes, it is. I think it's very clear that transmission outside is far less likely than it is indoors. Really, what you're talking about is a respiratory virus that is passed in breathing and in talking to people at proximity. So you're talking about groups of people indoors for the most part. So in pubs or at events where you're all cooped up together, all grouped in one place, and it's coming out of people's breath. And when they speak, that means that the virus circulates amongst us quite easily. And really, there's no hiding place. When you're outside, this is getting dispersed by the air. So another mitigating thing we can do, for instance, is open all the windows and get air currents circulating. That will help. It's very interesting. There was a study in China of transmissions, and I think it was something like 300 plus outbreaks. In only one case did they find that the virus had been transmitted and somebody had become infected out of doors. And that was two people who were close together talking for some time.
But are those dangers still mitigated when you have a lot of people outdoors? So we saw those photos last week on the south coast of thousands of people crowding onto beaches.
From promenade to water's edge and beyond, Bournemouth's golden sands disappeared under gigantic crowds.
Let's look at these pictures again. The whole world talking about what was happening at Bournemouth on the south coast of England. Tens of thousands of people were on that sand yesterday, the hottest day of the year to date, trying to get some relief from the heat.
Is that still safe, even when there are a lot of people around?
I think it looked really bad, but it's probably safer than people assume, because the virus will be dispersed if it's around in the air. You're also getting people moving about. If you're in a tight group of people on the beach where somebody's got the virus and you're with those people for a long time, then perhaps you might be at danger. But I really don't think that if you're running about in the sea, for instance, there's anything like the same sort of risk.
And holidaymakers might be hopeful that rather than packing onto crowded beaches in the UK, they can get abroad this summer too, with the opening of so-called air bridges between England and other European countries.
Thank you for calling Hayes Travel. Samantha speaking, how can I help?
At this branch of Hayes Travel in Sunderland, the phone's already ringing.
There's a very big percentage, very big number of people who really want to get away this summer, and we're anticipating a big surge in actual bookings.
How might this affect the spread of the virus?
Travelling between two countries depends very much on what's going on in each of those countries. So if we had a high level of virus here, then other countries which have managed to bring it right down would perhaps worry about that slightly. So the air bridges would be countries that have both got low levels of virus and agree that people should travel between them. I think a lot of countries are perhaps going to bring in quarantine restrictions, or at least testing or some sort of temperature check. So that will help to hopefully pick up people who introduce the virus. This is the risk. You have to remember that the virus in the UK actually came from people in Italy who were infected. So obviously it travels from country to country very easily. And that's what everybody will worry about. And I think actually scenes of crowds on the south coast might actually alarm some other countries, and that might make them less willing to agree to some sort of air bridge with us.
Within these changes, though, Sarah, there do seem to be some quite odd discrepancies. You know, we still can't have manicures, for example, and we can't go bowling, and we also can't go to the gym. Why is this?
Well, I think in a way there's very little difference between hairdressing and a manicure when it comes to the risk, although you could say that the hairdresser is standing behind you, whereas the manicurist is definitely going to be in front of you, or at least at best slightly to the side, depends how far you can twist your arm. But the fact is that hairdressing is sort of seen to be quite an imperative. An awful lot of people now really are in need of a haircut.
Almost as eagerly awaited as a pint will be a haircut, particularly by me, Mr. Speaker.
So I think there will be great efforts made to ensure that hair salons can have people in. They're going to have very robust restrictions. They're going to have to wear face visors, and they're only going to have one or two people in at a time. And the chairs have to be quite a distance apart. And I'm not sure that they're allowed to blow dry hair, because that might get the virus circulating around the salon. That's the idea. As far as gyms are concerned, I think that's a lot to do with the amount of air that people expel when they're making an effort.
One of the reasons the government argues they can lift these restrictions, Sarah, is that the rate of infection, or the R rate, is below one and has been hovering there for the past few weeks. But I've noticed, though, that the celebratory tone that Boris Johnson has taken in announcing these changes has not been matched by Chris Whitty.
If people don't take the mitigation seriously, if people hear a distorted version of what's being said that says, this is all fine now, it's gone away, and start behaving in ways that they normally would have before this virus happened, yes, we will get an uptick, for sure.
Is he right to be worried?
I think it's not just Chris Whitty. My perception of it is that all the scientists are really quite nervous about this.
The presidents of the Royal Colleges of Physicians, Surgeons, GPs and Nurses have outlined their concerns in a letter published in the British Medical Journal.
Health professionals say many lessons need to be learned in case the virus surges again.
We still don't have an answer as to why my colleagues from the Black, Asian, minority ethnic groups are more likely to die from this illness. These are all things that urgently need looking into in a no-blame, forward-looking way.
They again accept that they have to balance the risks to health against the risks to the economy. And obviously, the scientist, and particularly chief medical officer, is going to worry more about health, but he knows that in the real world, they have to look at the economic arguments as well. There's also something else going on, which is mental health. And frankly, an awful lot of people are feeling anxious, and really, it's not good for us to be, first of all, worried about our health the whole time, and secondly, unable to mix with people we loved and see more of our friends.
A survey by the UK's Mental Health Foundation found almost one in four adults questioned had feelings of loneliness during lockdown. That figure was one in 10 shortly before lockdown.
I mean, it's hard, isn't it, Sarah? Because on the one hand, there are those who are really looking forward to having a bit more freedom now. And then on the other hand, you've got people who have been shielding for months who are understandably very anxious about being allowed to go out again.
I won't be going shopping for a while. I still don't feel secure out there.
But the concern underlying everything is that the virus hasn't gone away and that there is a risk of reinfection, of a second wave. Is that inevitable?
It's not inevitable if we have a really good test and trace system working. But the signs are at the moment that the test and tracing system isn't working as well as you would hope. The Office of National Statistics studies show that there are a lot more people being infected with the virus than are actually being tested. That's the first thing. And secondly, you're only getting something like 3/4 of people at best who are actually cooperating with the contact tracers. There will be flare-ups, there's no doubt about that.
Just when Leicester was back open for business, parts of the city could be about to shut down again. Officials say there's been a surge in coronavirus cases in June, 658 in 2 weeks. Among those testing positive, workers at this sandwich factory.
But then you've got the really worrying scenario of the winter. It's just too cold to be out the whole time. And inside, if we're mixing with other people, there's far more risk that we're going to transmit the virus if we're infected.
All of this sounds like it could potentially be very worrying, Sarah, but are we going to be better prepared this time around?
Oh, yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that. The difference now is that we've all become very aware of the coronavirus. But also, the NHS is going to be much better prepared. They now have experience of dealing with this virus. They're far less frightened of it than they were to start with. And we do have some drugs that are beginning to have an effect. And really, I think that we won't be in anything like the same situation.
After this, the incredible scientific breakthroughs and medical advances that will help to combat a second wave of coronavirus cases. Let's talk about some of those medical and scientific breakthroughs over the last few months. What have scientists discovered in their search for a treatment for coronavirus?
This has been really terrific. They've had a breakthrough with one of the drugs. They've been testing a range of drugs, and they've come up with one called dexamethasone, which is a really cheap, very old steroid. It's over 60 years old. And what they found is that reduces the inflammation in the lungs, and it actually does cure some of those people who are most acutely ill.
Pete Herring says he's lucky to be alive. He spent 5 days in intensive care with severe COVID. But as part of his treatment at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, Pete was given the steroid dexamethasone.
I'm sure I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that drug, because something kicked in, because I was, looking back, I was going downhill quite fast.
There's another drug too called remdesivir, and that's been shown to reduce the length of time people take to recover. So we've got two things that we didn't have back at the start of this crisis, and they really will help.
You spoke to Mervyn Singer, who's a professor of intensive care medicine at University College London. What did he say about how his team have also changed the way they treat coronavirus patients? And what have they learned about how the virus affects people?
Mervyn Singer is very interesting on this. When they began treating people at UCL, they thought they were going to have to ventilate everybody. A lot of people thought that. And it was partly the experience of Italy, where virtually all patients were being put on ventilators. And that was one of the reasons why there was a really very big push to increase the number of ventilators that the UK had. But they've quite quickly found that they didn't need to do that, and that a lot of patients were recovering without being ventilated, which is far better for them and their long-term health. So they're using ventilators a lot less. He thinks they would be less paranoid about the risk of infection if it comes back again, which means that they'll be less worried about a type of ventilation, for instance, that involves humidification, which means that water particles end up in the air from the patient's lungs. One of the other things they've realised is that although obviously this disease hits the lungs really badly, it's actually affecting the blood vessels that are in the lungs. The virus attacks the lining of the blood vessels, and it makes them more likely to clot. So you're getting a lot of blood clots. You're getting an increased rate of strokes, for instance, as a result of that, and heart attacks. And that does mean that there are other ways that they can treat people. They will be putting people on blood thinners a lot more than they would have done.
You're mentioning blood clots in the lungs. Are the team also learning more then about how this virus affects people's bodies on a long-term basis?
So for people who have recovered, unfortunately, there are still concerns. People are getting out of hospital, fantastic. But then when they're convalescing, it's taking a long time for them to get back to normal. And some people may not get fully back to the way they were. There may be long-term lung damage for those people who've been particularly badly affected. And it is starting to look as if there may be, for some people, some long-term effects on the brain as well. But it is too soon to tell. And we don't know at all how many people are going to be affected.
Chris Whitty has said that we're in this the long haul when it comes to this virus.
I would be surprised and delighted if we weren't in this current situation through the winter and into next spring. I think then let's regroup and work out where we are. But I expect there to be a significant amount of coronavirus circulating at least into that time. And I think it's going to be quite optimistic or a renaissance fully to come to the rescue over that kind of time frame.
And we all know that the only way out is to find a vaccine. How far have scientists got in the process of discovering one?
Vaccine discovery is going on at a rate of knots. It's quite extraordinary. In the past, it's taken years to find vaccines. And now they're into human trials in several different vaccines within months. There are about 120 vaccines in development around the world. Two of the leading vaccines at the moment actually are in the UK. I think the Oxford University one started human trials a few weeks ago. And more recently, the human trial stage of the Imperial vaccine has started as well.
This is a really unusual vaccine. The synthetic genetic code it contains should instruct muscle cells to produce the spike protein found on the surface of coronavirus. That should prompt the creation of antibodies.
I think they're hoping that by the end of the year, we'll start to see something of the effectiveness of these vaccines. And that would be fantastic. But at the same time, we shouldn't expect that we're going to have a single vaccine that will just protect everybody around the world straight away. Just won't happen that way. Professor Sarah Gilbert from Oxford University, who was giving evidence at the House of Lords Science and Technology Committee the other day, pointed out that we might get a vaccine that's only 50% effective, so it would only protect half the people who get it. And actually, that would be good. If you protect half the people, you save a lot of lives and you also save a lot of infections.
Ideally, you'd have a highly effective vaccine that works very well in all age groups, and you'd start by targeting healthcare workers and then the older population. But if it doesn't work so well in the older population, by vaccinating more of the public-facing population who are likely to be responsible for transmission, and possibly children as well, who often spread viruses around even if they don't become severely ill themselves. And we've seen that in flu. Vaccinating children against flu protects the older population in the area against flu as well.
Sarah, for a lot of people on Saturday, the lifting of restrictions is going to feel like a release, I think, the chance to have a pint in a pub or a dinner with friends. But is it too early for us to celebrate yet?
I think it is too early to celebrate. I think we're entitled to a sort of cautious and calm relief, a feeling of, well, you know, we've got this far and thank goodness, and isn't it nice to be out again? It's a very good moment, but we do have to be very careful. Last week, The Guardian published a set of data which showed that of the 45 countries that have had more than 25,000 coronavirus cases so far, 21 have relaxed their responses to the pandemic, and half of those are now reporting a rise in the numbers of cases. So this is absolutely something that has to be very carefully managed, which is up to all of us, actually, as much as it's up to the government. I think it's in everybody's hands, really, to keep this thing at bay.
Sarah, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
That was Sarah Bosley. You can read all of her coverage of the coronavirus pandemic at theguardian.com, where you can also listen to her on The Guardian's brilliant Science Weekly podcast. Last week, she looked at the impact the virus has on smokers, and it's well worth your time. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef, and sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.